rather more civilized than Baudelaire's, and the inattentive reader might think her paper actually to be an endorsement of the work and ambitions of high art photographers of the time. But it seems to me that if one makes allowances for different rhetorical styles, both are saying much the same thing. Lady Eastlake liked the early calotype pictures better, like, again, this one by D.O. Hill. She liked them better than the new collodion sort, with their soft papers and their broad impressionistic indication. They resembled a little prints of the older graphic processes, and beyond that, their very imperfections had encouraged one to hold high hope for their future. In the first years of photography, if these modest first efforts, admittedly experiments and often crude, were as interesting as they were, how wonderful might photography be when the process was perfected? Well, Lady Eastlake's answer in 1857 was that they were less wonderful now that they were perfect. Both the mystery and the suspense were gone. She said, "The science which has developed the resources of photography has but more glaringly betrayed its defects. It is superfluous, therefore, to ask whether art has been benefited where nature, its only source and model, has been but more accurately falsified." She also said, "For everything for which art, so-called, has hitherto been the means but not the end, photography is the allotted agent. For all that requires mere manual correctness, mere manual slavery without any employment of the artistic feeling, she is the proper and therefore the perfect medium." A year later, Baudelaire said photography, quote, "has become art's most mortal enemy. It is time then for it to return to its true duty, which is to be the servant of science, of the sciences and the arts, but a very humble servant, like printing or shorthand, which have neither created nor supplemented literature." He may not have liked his portrait by Carjat, although everyone else has. Well, it is difficult to know for sure. Actually, it is difficult even to guess which photographs might have ranked near the top of the hit lists of Lady Eastlake and Baudelaire. I'm sure we would all have our own nominations. I might nominate these two pictures by Oscar Raylander. The one on the left screen being called, I think, The Carpenter's Family, not being satisfied with this degree of maudlin sentimentality, Raylander then hoped it up a little bit by adding additional exposures and turning it into a kind of a dream photograph, the title of which I have forgotten. But if you send me stamped, self-addressed.
A spiritistical photograph.
Thank you very much. A spiritistical, there, how do you like that? A spiritistical photograph. Thank you. However, there's no reason to think that either Lady Eastlake or Baudelaire were talking about excesses such as these. Uh, Here's a photograph by an early commercial photographer, what in my youth we called nuts and bolts photographer, Frenchman by the name of Durandel. It seems to me it would be hard to find a photograph that would more aptly meet Baudelaire's prescription for a photograph that is serves the role of a very humble servant, recording useful facts without attempting to comment in any way on the philosophical meaning of those facts. Durandel's photographs, as some of you may recognize, sort of the slide is awfully dark, I apologize. Is a picture of a, how do you say, cartouche, would you call it a cartouche, from Garnier's opera before installation. Seems to me it should satisfy the sternest conditions of selfless servility. And yet, to us, carrying the heavy inherited load of modernist baggage that we do carry, it seems to me there is something odd about it, something a little askew, something not so straight as even Durandel may have thought. I want to come back to the Durandel, but first I'd like to return for a moment to Lady Eastlake. That's so dear, you must focus upon. Actually, I think this picture is a few years out of my time period, but I wanted you to see it. And I want to quote one short fragment toward the end of Lady Eastlake's essay. When she seems to be almost ruminating to herself about why a medium so fundamentally flawed can nevertheless on occasion make pictures that constrict our throats. She said, though the faces of our children in a photograph may not be modeled and rounded with that truth and beauty that art attains, yet minor things, the very shoes of the one, the inseparable toy of the other, are given with a strength of identity which art does not seek. The same year, American Oliver Wendell Holmes, a great fan of photography, said the same thing with more confidence, with more conviction. He said, what is the picture of the drum without the marks on its head where the beating of the sticks have darkened the parchment? Well, in the Durandel, again, I find it quite a wonderful picture. The cartouche is seen with an independent identity that it would soon lose forever to become part of the complex tapestry of Garnier's masterpiece. It is, in fact, itself almost like a metaphor for a photograph, a bit of the whole, in a context that is elliptical and ambiguous. Well, yes, it is ambiguous, but it's really about bondage, isn't it? The fresh, glowing, still innocent body of the thing bound to an improvised rack in what might be a deserted warehouse, the hideout of the perpetrators of this awful violation. All right, I'll strike that. Well, draftsmen and engravers had certainly performed similarly humble and instrumental tasks, similar to the one assigned here to Durandel, even before photography was invented, although surely not in comparable quantity and variety. But no draftsman would have been so dull, so servile, as to include in his drawing those irrelevant, extraneous details. The ropes, the improvised easel, the black marks on the drum's head that Durandel could not avoid. Two pictures by one of the all-time greats, as we say, Timothy O'Sullivan. I wanted to show you the one on the right, upside down, and tell you that it was a snow scene. Partly to see whether I could have gotten away with it, but partly so I could see it myself upside down. But Mr. Sobieszek said no, it would be wrong. I can't remember, 1871, 69, somewhere in there. And ND, as we say, same period. I postulate even worse, I take it as a self-evident truth that artists of high talent are alert to and make use of new visceral knowledge that is only later described approximately in words, named, and catalogued by historians and critics and curators. It is, I believe, this alertness to possibilities not yet assigned a name and a habitation that defines what we mean when we speak of exceptional artists. Thus, although it is not difficult to assemble thick catalogs that document the debt of specific paintings, good, bad, and indifferent paintings, more often bad and indifferent paintings, to prior good, bad, and indifferent photographs, I think it is probably impossible to document with any rigor the influence of photography on painting, for the most important function of photography vis-a-vis the traditional arts was not its function as a sketching medium, a substitute for the preparatory drawing, but as the source of a new sensibility, an expanded sense of the unexpected nooks and crannies in which the seeds of a new kind of visual truth might lie. On the right, Roger Fenton in the Crimea, 1850, whatever, five or six. And George Barnard in the during the American Civil War. It would be a great boon to art historians if we were to discover the negative file of that great, still unknown, eccentric photographer of the French Third Republic, who did not make portraits of the painters, as everyone else did, but who instead made photographs recording with obsessive indiscrimination the scrappy vernacular images, including photographs, that were tacked to the walls of the painters' studios. The file of this photographer, if there was or is such a photographer, has not yet come to light. But there is some documentation from the late part of that epoch, the late part of the Third Republic, that would seem to record the self-edited interest of painters in photography. In 1928, in the latter years of the Third Republic, when photomechanical reproductions had become a common and economical option, Amadei Ozenfant published the first edition of his Foundations of Modern Art, a fascinating, stimulating, surrational, wholly non-academic work that explained the true and the false of the modern experiment as Ozenfant saw it. The book is full of photographs that excited Ozenfant, not because he thought them art, but because they challenged his understanding of the fundamental material and ideas from which art might be made. To me, the most interesting thing in Ozenfant's selection of photographs is that none of them bear a direct fraternal resemblance to any of Ozenfant's paintings. I think we can project backwards from this example and assume that the most important influence of photography on modern painting in the 19th century also was in its effect on the painter's sense of the possible meaning of dumb facts, not simply in the way that photographs made things look. Well, I said in the beginning that my analysis would be superficial, and in fact, I have concerned myself only with the modernist idea as it applies to the art of painting. But before relinquishing the lectern, I should at least like to wave at the relationship between photography and literature. I'll restrict myself to a single case and choose Stephen Crane and the Red Badge of Courage. This is the last picture, and it is the one above all others that I would love to have sharp. Crane was born 5 years after the war ended, but Ernest Hemingway said of Crane that he had known the aging veterans hunkering on the porch of the general store and sharing remembrances, and also that he had surely known what Hemingway called the great Brady photographs. Well, it is virtually certain that he did, like most Americans of his generation. What is more speculative is what he learned from them. The picture on the screen is by Timothy O'Sullivan. It is called Slaughter Pen. And what seems at first glance to be a simple landscape gradually turns into a picture like those that they had in the comics of my childhood, in which one might get a prize according to how many faces one could find in the clouds. But here it is, bodies. I will read you a fragment from Crane's great novel, proposed as evidence that he learned something about war from the so-called Brady pictures that he could never have learned from those of Benvenuto Gozzoli or Velázquez or even Goya. The novel, as you know, does not attempt to explain the war. It attempts rather to realize, to make real, the personal trial of one anonymous, ignorant participant who sees the event from so close a perspective that the large patterns are invisible. This is Crane. It seemed to the youth that he saw everything. Each blade of grass was bold and clear. He thought he was aware of every change in the thin, transparent vapor that floated idly in sheets. The brown or gray trunks of the trees showed each roughness of their surfaces, and the men of the regiment, with their slanting eyes and sweating faces, running madly or falling as if thrown headlong to queer, heaped-up corpses. All were comprehended. His mind took a mechanical but firm impression, so that afterwards everything was pictured and explained to him, save why he himself was there. This seems to me an extraordinarily clear and elegant expression of a radically new sensibility, defined in large part, I think, by photography. Well, in closing, I should admit that I have perhaps missed the essential question, perhaps even as Lady Eastlake and Baudelaire did, but at this date with surely less excuse. If I have unwittingly spoken of photography and modernism, as though photography was an alien infection affecting a discrete culture called modernism, I did not mean to. I believe that photography, the idea that one might make meaningful pictures by intercepting a field of force with a net, was both the logical end of the ideas of Alberti and Brunelleschi and a part of the beginning of the new ideas of Degas and Proust and Joyce and Picasso and Walker Evans and the rest. Since I am not yet smart enough to pursue that intuition, I am relieved to see that my time has expired. But if you should invite me back for the bicentennial of the invention of photography, I will try to continue then. Thank you. After a decent pause to allow those to escape who would. If there are questions, I will try to evade them. Depending on whether they're hard or easy. If they're easy, I'll try to answer them. Yes.
What
What tack? Well, I was trying to explain it to Robert earlier, and I'm not sure I did a very good job at it, but I told him a story that Jean Renoir reports, which is the basic idea of it. I'll tell you his story. During the First War, Jean, the great filmmaker, as you all know, was home. He was injured, and he went home to Provence or wherever the old man was to recuperate. And his father was old and rheumatic and cranky and crippled and in not very good sorts a lot of the time. And at one point, he was bitching that painting had really gone totally to pot, and that the best people of his own generation couldn't hold a candle to the old masters, and the young people were really outrageous. They were even worse. And it was all the fault of the system. And in the old days, it was better because the painters would become apprentices at the age of 12, and they'd have to spend 8 years grinding pigments and learning how to plaster a wall properly, or stretching canvases, or sizing them, or transferring cartoons, before they ever would even get to paint in a blue sky. I mean, that was the way to do it, you know. Then he stopped to think for a minute, catch his breath, and he kind of recovered his good humor, and he said, on the other hand, if it hadn't been for paint and tubes, there never would have been anything called Impressionism. Hmm? That's the basis. I think that technological change, including such thing, including how you sell your pictures, how you distribute your pictures, everything. What happens when the photomechanical block, the halftone block comes in? All of those are issues that all photographers have got to deal with, one way or another. You accept them, you react against them, you hide from them, you do something. But it changes the playing field for everybody. So that's the organizing principle. I think with a little muscling, I can get just about everything in under that rubric. Yes?
Can you comment a little on the ability of the different early processes to manipulate the image and the extent to which?
Well, that was one of the reasons that the artists loved the calotype. You could really push it around. The daguerreotype, it came out. It was like, again, it was like a Polaroid. You push the button and that's what you get, you know, if you don't like it. Whereas when you had a negative, that was a kind of a point of departure, and you could make it lighter, darker, harder in contrast, softer in contrast. You know, you could crop it, you could retouch it, you could paint out parts of it. So that it was plastic. The daguerreotype was totally unplastic. It was really unforgiving. So that especially the paper negative system was in that sense very much more spiritually compatible to an artist who was accustomed to the idea of traditional graphic media. Was that?
Raul?
Yes.
To what extent people commented on this job, the photographers, to what extent they were aware of their ability to manipulate the image, was this just first from a technical point of view, or was it, were their artistic imperatives in that manipulation pretty early on?
Excellent and complicated question, because it depends on who the audience is. The fancy French calotypists speaking to each other, or the English calotypists speaking within their own little circle, you know, they would, of course, they would love to talk about that, because they understood what they were doing. What they were doing was art. The nuts and bolts photographer, the commercial practitioner, might push it around just as much, But he didn't want to, talk about that, because he made his living from the faith of the people that this was a kind of an act of God. I mean, that this was the truth. It simply was not in the working photographer's self-interest to do a lot of talking about how he was, how he was arting it up. Francis Frith, who did the big pyramid picture, I saw one of his original plates a couple of years ago, and it's absolutely astonishing. It's covered with tissue, various layers of tissue paper, red dye, you know, taking out this, putting it, but you don't see it. So part of the, anything was fair as long as you couldn't see it, because if you could see it, it didn't look true anymore. Whereas with the high art types, they didn't so much mind if you saw it, because that was... evidence of their skill at manipulating a medium that they were willing to admit was plastic. Thank you very much. You've been very nice.